long gone before the people hunting us can get organized enough to track us to our doorstep. We'll have warning and a good means of escape. I can sell the van for cash in Knoxville and use another identity to buy something else. Break the trail again. At least, that's what I tell myself. I'm getting up from the table when my phone rings. Well, vibrates, since I generally keep it in quiet mode. I've seen too many movies where victims brainlessly forget and their ringtones give them away to their killers. I reach for it and see Lanny's name pop up. Well, I can't say I haven't been expecting it. Lanny's acting out is, I think, only going to get worse. Maybe it's for the best we get moving sooner rather than later. I can homeschool instead, wherever we land. When I answer, Lanny says in a tense and unnaturally flat voice, "I can't find Connor, Mom." I don't understand for a few seconds. My brain refuses to consider the possibilities, the horrible truth of it. Then my breath becomes concrete, heavy in my chest, and I feel like I will never breathe again. I gain control again and say, "What do you mean, you can't find him? He's in class." "He skipped," she says. "Mom, he never skips. Where would he go?" "Where are you?" "I went looking for him to give him his stupid lunch because he forgot it on the bus again. But his homeroom teacher said he wasn't there, and he never showed up for class at all. Mom, what do we do? Is he..." Lanny was starting to panic now, her breath coming too fast, her voice trembling. "I'm at home. I came home because I thought maybe he came back here, but I can't find him." "Honey? Honey? Sit down. Is the alarm on?" "What? What does it matter? Brady's not here." In her distress, my daughter is calling her brother by his birth name, something she hasn't done for years. It sends a shock through me, hearing his name from her. I try to stay calm. "Lanny, I want you to go turn on the alarm if it isn't on right now, and then sit down. Take deep, slow breaths, in through your nose, out through your mouth. I'm on my way."
"Hurry," Lanny whispers. "Please, Mom, I need you."
She's never said that before, and it drives a knife deep into me and cuts out something soft and vulnerable and vital. I hang up. Javi is already on his feet, watching me. "You need some help?" he asks, and I nod. "We'll take the jeep," he says. "It's faster." Javi drives like the road is a combat zone, fast and aggressive, nothing smooth about it. I don't mind him taking the wheel. I'm not sure I'm in any shape right now to do it. I hang on hard through bumps he doesn't slow down for. The jolts rattling through me are nothing compared to the constant jittery terror, and I can think of nothing but Connor's face. The vision of him lying bloody and dead in his bed haunts me, even though I know he isn't there. Lanny checked the house, and he isn't there. But where is he? The question goes silent in my mind as Javi pulls the jeep into a sliding stop in the driveway of our house. I am still now, ready, the way I'm ready on the range with a target in the distance. I climb out of the jeep and head for the door, unlock it, and quickly disarm the siren just before Lanny flings herself on me. I hug my daughter, inhale the scent of strawberry shampoo and clean soap, and think about how far I will go to protect her from anything, anyone who wants to hurt her. Javi enters after me, and Lanny breaks free with a gasp, taking a step back in defense. I don't blame her. She doesn't know him. He's just a stranger looming in her doorway. "Lanny, this is Javier Esperanza," I tell her. "Javi is the instructor over at the shooting range. He's a friend." She raises her black eyebrows a little at that, momentarily amazed because she knows I don't trust people lightly, but she doesn't waste time on it.
"I checked the house," she says. "He isn't here, Mom. I can't see he came back at all."
"Okay, let's take a breath," I say, though I want to scream. I go to the kitchen where I keep a list of phone numbers pinned to the wall, my son's teachers and the home and cell numbers of his friend's parents. It's a short list. I start dialing, starting with the friends. My anxiety ramps up with every ring, every answer, every negative. When I put the phone down after the last call, I feel hollow, lost. I look up at Lanny, and her eyes are huge and dark.
Mom, she says, is it Dad? Is it...
No, I say, an instant and unthinking rejection. Out of the corner of my eye, I see Javier noting it. He already believes that I'm running from someone. This just confirms it. But Mel is in prison. He's never getting out, except in a pine box. I'm more worried about other people. Angry people. The internet trolls. Not to mention the justifiably enraged relatives and friends of the women Mel tormented and murdered. But how did they find us? Still, I flash back to the pictures from just a few days ago. The faces of my children photoshopped onto bloody, destroyed bodies. Onto suffering, abused bodies. If they had him, I think, they would have taunted me by now. It's the only thing that keeps me sane. You were supposed to walk him to class after you got off the bus, Lanny, I say. She flinches and drops her gaze from mine. Lanny?
I had things to do, she says defensively. He went on ahead. It was no big deal.
She stops, because she knows that it is a big deal.
I'm sorry, I should have. I got off the bus with him. He was being an asshole, and I yelled at him to go to class, and I went across the street to the convenience store. I know I'm not supposed to.
From the bus, Connor would have walked across the grassy triangle between the schools to the middle building. It would have been more likely for him to run into bullies than abductors, though there would have been plenty of parents dropping off kids outside the guard station entrance. I don't know. I don't know what he did. What happened to him once Lanny turned away?
Mom, maybe,
she licks her lips.
Maybe he just went somewhere by himself.
I fix her with a long look. What are you saying? She looks away and seems so uncomfortable that I want to shake it out of her. I'm able to stop myself, barely.
Sometimes he goes off by himself. He likes to be on his own, you know? Maybe that's where he went.
Gwen, Javi says, this is serious business. You should call the police.
He's right. Of course he's right. But we've already drawn the police's attention once. If my son, of all people, has been sneaking away, being on his own, that frightens me in a way I can't even explain. His father liked to be on his own.
Lanny, I say, I need you to think now. Is there some special place he goes to be alone? Any place at all? In Norton? Around here?
She shakes her head, clearly frightened, clearly feeling guilty for having walked away from him this morning, for having failed in her duty as an older sister.
I don't know, Mom. Around here, he likes to go up in the woods. That's all I know.
It's not enough. Javi says quietly, I'll drive around and see what I can spot, if you want.
Yes, I say. Please, please do that. I swallow hard. I'll call the police. It's the last thing I want to do. It's a dangerous move, just as dangerous as having Lanny as a potential witness to a body disposal. We need shadows, not spotlights. But every second I waste could be a second that Connor, hurt or, God forbid, taken, stands in real danger. Javi heads for the exit. I start to dial the phone. We both pause as a knock sounds on the door. Javi gives me a look over his shoulder, and when I nod, he swings it open. The alarm chimes but doesn't go off. In the panic, I'd forgotten to reset it. Standing on the doorstep is my son, with an inadequately wiped bloody nose and a man I barely recognize.
Connor!
I rush forward, past Javi, to grab my son in a hug. He makes a gurgling sound of protest, and some of his blood smears on my shirt, but I don't care. I let go and go to one knee to look at his damage.
What happened?
Got in a fight, I guess, says the man who's brought my son back to me. He's medium height, medium weight, sandy, dark blonde hair cut short, but not as short as Javi's. He has an open, interesting face and eyes that lie steady on the two of us. Hi, Sam Cade. I live up the ridge. I finally remember him from two different sightings,
First, he'd stepped in at the gun range against Carl Goetz, and second, I'd seen him walking down the road below our house, earbuds in, waving quietly to us. He offers a hand. I don't take it. I usher my son inside, where Lanny grabs his arms and drags him off to see that his nose is cleaned up as it drips more dark blood. Javi stands quietly, arms folded, a silent presence that feels very, very comforting right now. What are you doing with my son? It comes out sharp, urgent. I see Cade's Adam's apple bob as he swallows, but he doesn't take a step back. I found him sitting on the dock. I walked him home. That's it. I glare at him because I'm not sure that I can believe him. Still, he's brought Connor home, and Connor doesn't seem afraid of him. Not in the least. I remember you, from the gun range, right? There's still a sharp edge to my voice. Right, he says. My tone has brought a slight flush to his cheeks, but he's working not to sound defensive. I'm renting the cabin up the hill there, the one up to the east, just here for 6 months or so. And how do you know my son? I just told you I don't, he says. I found him sitting on the dock. He was bleeding, so I cleaned him up and brought him home. The end. I hope he's okay. He's matter of fact, but his voice is getting firmer. He wants this to be over. How exactly did he get hurt? Cade sighs, looks up at the sky as if searching for patience. Look, lady, I was just trying to be nice. For all I know, you hit the kid. Did you? I'm taken aback. No, of course not. But he's right, of course. If I'd found a kid sitting with a nosebleed, I'd wonder if he was running from abuse at home. I've come at this all wrong, and too aggressively. I'm sorry. I should be thanking you, Mr. Cade, not giving you the third degree. Please, come inside. I'll make you some iced tea. Iced tea, in the South, is the hallmark of hospitality, shorthand code for making someone welcome, and the all-purpose apology. Did Connor tell you anything about what happened? Anything at all? He just said it was kids at school, Cade says. He doesn't follow me in. He stands on the outside, looking in. Maybe Javi's silent presence is warning him off. I don't know. I make the glass of tea and bring it to the door. He accepts, though he holds it as if he's not quite sure what it's for. Takes a tentative sip. I can instantly tell this is not a man who's used to the Southern traditions, because the sweetness of it surprises him. He doesn't quite make a face. I'm sorry, I didn't even ask your name. I'm Gwen Proctor, I say. Connor's my son, obviously, and you saw my daughter, Atlanta. Javi clears his throat. Gwen, I should probably get going. I'm going to walk to the range. I've got a bike there I can ride home. You bring the jeep back and pick up the van whenever you want. He puts the keys on the coffee table and nods to Sam Cade. Mr. Cade. Mr. Esperanza, Cade says. I can't leave a stranger standing here with my iced tea glass in his hand, obviously, and I'm not ready to run off and leave Lanny and Connor at home alone either. So I let Javier go, though I hold him back for a moment to look him in the face. Javi, thank you. Thank you so much. Glad it worked out, he replies. And then he's gone past Cade, ambling down the drive, then kicking into an easy, loping run toward the gun range on the ridge. Marine, I remember. This is just a quick jaunt for him. No effort at all. I return my attention to Cade, who is looking after Javi with an expression I can't read. Let's sit out here? I make it a question. He seems to think about it, then eases down into a chair on the porch. He perches on the edge of it, ready to bounce up and go at any moment. His sips of tea seem more polite than appreciative. Okay, I say. I'm sorry. Let's start over. I'm sorry for accusing you of, well, of anything. That wasn't fair. Thank you for helping Connor. I really appreciate it. I was freaking out. Can't imagine, he says. Well, they wouldn't be kids if they didn't make it a mission to freak out parents, right? Right, I say. But it's a hollow sort of agreement. That might be true of normal kids. Mine are different. They've had to be. I can't believe he didn't call me, that's all. He should have called me.
I think... Cade hesitates, like he's thinking about a line he doesn't want to step across.
I think he was just ashamed. He didn't want his mom to know he lost a fight.
I manage a hollow, shaky laugh. Is that normal for boys?
He shrugs, which I take to mean yes.
Javier's a Marine. You might want to ask him to show the kid a few moves.
I thank him, but inwardly I'm thinking that Sam Cade can also handle himself. He's compact, but not small, and he has a lithe tension in him that makes me think he's had experience at being picked on and hitting back. Where Javi is so visibly military that someone would have to be blind to miss it, Cade comes across as a normal guy, but with an edge. On impulse, I say, Army? He glances at me, startled.
Hell no. Air Force. Once upon a time, he says. Afghanistan. What gave it away?
You just leaned a little hard on the word Marine, I say.
Yeah, okay. Guilty of inter-forces rivalry.
His smile this time is unguarded, and I like him better for it.
The advice stands, though. In an ideal world, sure, he wouldn't have to fight back. But the only thing more certain than death and taxes is bullies.
I'll consider it, I say. His body language is slowly relaxing, one muscle at a time, and he takes a deeper drink of the tea.
So you said you're only in the cabin for 6 months, is that right?
That's pretty short.
Writing a book, he says. Don't worry, I won't bore you to death with the plot or anything. But I was between jobs and I thought this would be the perfect place to come for peace and quiet before I head off to the next thing.
What's the next thing? He shrugs.
I don't know. Something interesting. And probably far away. I'm not much for being settled. I like experiences.
I would give anything to be settled and to avoid more experiences, but I don't tell him that. Instead, we sit in awkward silence for a moment, and as soon as his glass is empty, he stands up to go like he's been released from a trap. I shake his hand. He has a rough palm, like someone who's done plenty of hard work in his life. Thanks again for bringing Connor home, I say. He nods, but I realize he isn't looking at me. He's stepped back and is looking at the outside of the house.
What?
Oh, nothing.
Just thinking. You really should get those roof shingles fixed before the rain comes. You're going to have a hell of a leak.
I hadn't noticed, but he's right. One of the many spring storms has blown a sizable patch of roofing away, leaving fluttering tar paper exposed.
Damn it. Know any good roofers?
I don't mean it. I'm still half out the door, mentally planning our escape for when it's necessary. But he, of course, takes me seriously.
Not a single one around here, but I've done some roof work in my day. If you just want a repair, I can do it for you cheap.
I'll think about it, I tell him. Look, I'm sorry, but I need to see to my son. Thank you for being so kind.
That seems to make him uncomfortable.
Sure, he says.
Okay, sorry.
He rocks back and forth for a moment, as if debating saying something else, then casts me a quick glance.
Let me know.
Then he's gone without a backward look, hands in his pockets, head down and shoulders loose. He doesn't look back. I gather up the glasses and go back inside the house, and just as I'm closing the door, I see that Cade has paused a little bit up the hill to look back. I raise my hand silently. He raises his. And I shut the door. I wash out the glasses and knock on Connor's door. After a long moment, he says, "Come in." And I find him sprawled on his bed, game controller on his chest, all his attention on the screen across the room. He's playing some kind of racing game. I don't interrupt him. I sink down on the edge of his bed, careful not to block his view, and wait until his in-game vehicle crashes. He pauses the game before I reach out to smooth hair back from his forehead.
He's going to have an impressive bruise, I think, but no black eyes or there'd already be darkening from burst capillaries. There's another mark on his left cheek, just where a right-hander would have punched him, and I see raw scrapes on the palms of his hands, where he must have broken his fall. The knees of his blue jeans are abraded and bloodied. "Does it hurt?" I ask him. He shakes his head mutely. "Okay, sorry, I have to do this." I lean over and touch his nose, pushing and moving it to make sure that I don't feel anything strange. There isn't any break, I'm certain of that. I'll schedule a doctor's appointment in the next few days, just to make sure, though.
"Mom, enough!"
Connor pushes my hand away and picks up his game controller, but he doesn't start the game again, just fiddles with it idly.
"Who was it?" I ask him.
He shrugs. Not as if he doesn't know, of course, but he doesn't want to tell. He says nothing, but he doesn't start the new game either. If he didn't want to talk, I think, he'd have the thing roaring at top volume, standard avoidance technique these days.
"You'd tell me if you were in trouble, wouldn't you?" I ask him.
That draws his focus just for a moment.
"No, I wouldn't," he says. "Because if I did, you'd just pack us up and move us again, right?"
That hurts. It hurts because it's true. Javi's left me the Jeep, but I still have to go trade it for the van. And the instant I pull that big white beast into our driveway, my son will be proven right. Worse, now he's going to believe he's caused it to happen, as if his getting hit by bullies is forcing me to uproot the family. I hope Lanny doesn't decide to blame him, too, because there's no viciousness like that of a teen girl deprived of something she wants. And she wants to stay here. I know that, even if she doesn't. If I decide to move us again, it won't be because of anything you or your sister have done, I tell him. It'll be because it's the best, safest thing for us all. Okay, kid? We straight?
Straight, he says.
Mom, don't call me a kid. I'm not a kid.
I'm sorry, young man.
It's not like this is the first time I got punched. Won't be the last. It's not the end of the world. After another few seconds of fiddling, he puts the controller aside and rolls toward me, head propped up on his hand.
In his letters, does Dad ever say anything about us?
Lanny must have told him something, but she couldn't have told him all of it, certainly not what she'd read in that vile message. So I choose my words carefully.
He does, I say carefully.
Sometimes.
And why won't you at least read that part to us?
Because that wouldn't be fair. I can't just read you the part where he pretends to be a good dad.
He was a good dad. He didn't pretend about that.
My son says it with perfect calm, and it hurts. Hurts like a piece of iron shoved in where my heart should be. And of course he's right, from his perspective. His dad loved him. That's all he ever saw or knew. His dad was great. And then his dad was a monster. There was never any middle ground, no adjustment period. He saw his dad that morning of the event, hugged him, and by that evening his father was a murderer, and he wasn't allowed to mourn him, miss him, or love him ever again. I want to cry, but I don't. I say, it's okay to still love the times you had with your dad. But he was more than just your dad. And that other part? That other part was, and is, nothing you should love.
Yeah, Connor says, thumbing his game back on.
He isn't looking at me.
I wish he was dead.
That hurts, too, because I wonder if he's just saying it because he knows that I wish it, too. I wait, but he doesn't pause the game again. I say over the roar of the sound effects, you sure you won't tell me who hit you, and why?
Bullies and no reason. Geez, leave it, Mom. I'm fine.
Would you like to learn some moves from Javi? Or, I almost say Mr. Cade, but I stop myself. I just met the man. I don't really know how Connor feels about him. I don't know how I feel about him.
I'm not starring in some teen movie, he tells me. It doesn't work like that in real life. By the time I get any good, I'll be graduated.
Yeah, but think of the epic graduation fight, I tell him. Middle of the school auditorium, everybody cheering you while you take down your bullies.
He pauses the game.
More like me ending up bloody and in the hospital, and all of us getting charged with assault. They never show you that part in the movies.
I don't know quite how to phrase it, so I say, Connor, how did you meet Mr. Cade today?
Well, Mom, he lured me into a rape van with a puppy.
Connor! I'm not stupid.
He flings that at me like a knife, and I admit it startles. I start to speak, but he runs right over me, never taking his eyes off the screen, as the image of a car shifts lanes, speeds, jumps, rounds corners. I got beat up. I walked home. I sat on the dock, and he just asked me if I was okay. Don't make it some freaky serial dad creeper thing, all right? He was just nice. Not every guy in the world has to be an asshole.
I'm shocked, not only by what he says, but also by the anger behind it. I haven't realized how much my son has taken his anger and turned it on me until this moment. It's understandable, of course. Why wouldn't he? I'm here to represent the shitty life he leads, every day.
It begs a larger question. I do treat every person I meet with suspicion, and men more than women. I do that out of sheer self-preservation, but I realize now that in doing so I've appeared unreasonable in my son's eyes. After all, if I distrust those people, especially men, will I eventually look at him the same way? He has to wonder. After all, he's his father's child. It breaks my heart and shatters the pieces, and I feel tears gather in my eyes. I blink them away.
I'll get an ice pack for that nose, I tell him, and leave.
I run into Lanny in the kitchen. She's making lunch, enough for all of us, I see, a pasta chicken dish that she's spicing with great abandon. She's a good cook, if a little liberal on flavors. When I open the freezer, she hands me an ice pack already prepared.
Here, she says, rolling her eyes. Didn't want to interrupt Mommy's sun time.
Thanks, honey, I say, and I mean it.
Looks tasty.
Oh, you'll definitely taste it, she says cheerfully, continuing her stirring while I deliver Connor's ice pack. He's already laser-focused on the game, so I leave it next to him and hope he'll remember to use it before it melts.
Lanny, I say as I set the table, you should go back to school this afternoon. I'll call in an excuse for you.
Ha! No, I'm staying here.
Don't you have an English test?
Why do you think I'm staying here?
Lanny.
Okay, Mom, I get it. Fine, whatever.
She turns the burner off on the stove with an unnecessarily violent snap of her wrist and bangs the skillet down on the hot pad on the dinner table.
Eat up.
There's no use arguing. Go get your brother.
She does that without complaint, at least, and lunch is good. Filling. Even Connor seems to like it enough to try to smile, though he winces and probes at his swollen nose afterward. I place phone calls. Connor and I drive Lanny to school, and I think longingly again about the van that waits at Javier's house. I also think that running almost endures another stir of interest and eventual links to our real identities. Maybe we don't need to pull up our tentative roots quite so quickly. Maybe I'm overreacting, the way I did when I pointed a gun at my own son not so long ago. I'm well aware that my paranoia is part of my huge, overwhelming desire to never give up control ever again. And I know that same impulse could be hurting my children. Like Connor, caught between uncomplicated childhood love and adult hate, and nowhere to stand in between. Like Lanny, defiant and furious, and ready to take on the world, but far too young to do it. I need to think of them, what they need. And as I stand in the hallway and wipe tears from my cheeks, I realize that what they might need right now is for me to stand my ground and trust that we're going to get through this. Not just another hopeless late-night flight, another town, another set of names to memorize until none of them are real anymore. Their childhood has been incinerated, destroyed, and running
is one more log on that fire. It's ironic that there are protection programs for witnesses, but not for us. Never for us. But the body in the lake. It nags at me, having this spotlight focused so close to us. There are similarities to my husband's crimes, but I tell myself that it isn't an uncommon way to dispose of a body. I've done that research, obsessively, trying to understand Melvin Royal, trying to understand how that killer could be the man I thought I knew and loved. I can hear Mel's mental whisper again. The smartest ones are never found out. I never would have been, except for that stupid drunk driver. Our lives would have gone on just the same. That is almost certainly true. It's your fault I'm where I am, though. That was completely true. Mel would have been convicted of one murder, of course, but it was my fault his true depth of evil had been finally unmasked. Everything in our house had been gone over by the police, of course. They'd missed nothing. But what they hadn't known about, and I hadn't either, was that Mel had taken out a storage locker in the name of my long-dead brother. I only found out about it because the preloaded credit card associated with the account had run out after Mel's arrest, and I'd gotten a call from the storage unit. Apparently, ironically, he'd put the home phone number on the account. That voicemail had led me to the storage locker, and I'd opened it up to find a bewildering array of folded women's clothing, purses, shoes, small plastic bins, neatly labeled with victims' names, that contained the contents of their purses and pockets and backpacks. And the journal. It was a three-ring notebook, a leather presentation binder. It was filled with lined notebook paper densely covered in his neat, angular writing, with printed photographs. Each victim had a section. I'd only taken one single look before I'd dropped the book on the floor and rushed to call the police. I couldn't bear even what I'd learned from that glance. Mel's charges went from a single count of abduction, torture, and murder to multiple counts. The clerk's voice had gone hoarse before it was over, or so the newspaper accounts read. By that time, I was back in jail awaiting my own trial. In a rare display of spite, Mel had refused to exonerate me from his crimes, and a zealous, fame-hungry neighbor had claimed she saw me carrying something she thought might have been a body, though my attorney had picked that apart and gotten me an acquittal, eventually. "This man will kill again," Mel's voice says in my mind, and I shiver to reject it, reject him. "When he does, you think they won't look at you? Won't investigate? Take your picture? This ain't the old days, Gina. Reverse image search can bring the wolves right to your door." I know that voice isn't really Mel, and I also know it's right. The longer we stay here, the more we risk being pulled into Detective Prester's investigation, and that's a sure, slow fuse to blow up our semi-settled life. But taking this home away from Connor now would make his bitterness, his self-protective, guarded anger, that much worse. He's only just begun to relax, to feel part of something. Taking that away because we might be found out is cruel. Still, having the van ready isn't a bad idea. I take a deep breath and call Javier. I tell him I'll make time soon to make the swap, jeep for van, but there's no real hurry. He's okay with that. It feels like a plan. But some part of me also knows that it's really not enough. 4. I have learned not to trust anyone. Ever. I spend the night at the computer turning up everything I can about Sam Cade, who is indeed an Afghanistan Air Force vet. He's not on any sex offender registry, has no criminal record, and even has a good credit rating. I check the popular ancestry sites. Often somebody's name pops up in a family tree, and it's a good way to check out their history. But his family isn't enrolled. Cade's got a couple of social media accounts and a sort of boring dating profile on a match service, though it's several years out of date. I doubt he's even checked it for a long time. His posts are the normal kind of wry observations clever people make, with a support-the-military bent, but in a mostly non-political way, which is a bit of a miracle. He doesn't seem rabidly fanatical about anything. I'm looking for dirt, and I don't find any. I could contact Absalom and have him deep dive it, but the fact is I rely on him for very specific services, the one strictly to do with Mel and the stalker posse. If I abuse our fragile, faceless relationship, I could lose a vital resource. Checking out a neighbor probably isn't a good use of Absalom's time. Probably. Until I have some better reason to suspect Cade beyond my normal garden-variety paranoia, I can leave it. As long as he avoids me, I'll avoid him. Still, it's a little disquieting that when I step outside my front door, I realize that I can see his front porch from here. I've noticed it before, of course, but when we moved in, the cabin was empty, and I'd never found anyone at home when I'd come around the lake on my runs. We're in direct eyeline, though his cabin's modest and tucked in among the trees by the road. I can see the glow of lights in the front windows through red curtains. Sam Cade, like me, is a night owl. I sit in the quiet, listening to the owls and distant rustling of the trees. The lake ripples quietly and reflects shattered moonlight. It's beautiful. It's also very late. And I finish my drink and go to bed. I take Connor to the doctor to get his x-rays. He has bruises, but nothing's broken, and I'm supremely grateful for that. Lanny goes with us, though she's in silent mutiny the entire time, glowering at me and anyone who gives her a second look with equal displeasure. I ask Connor again if he'll talk about the person who hit him, but he's a well of silence. I let it go. When he's ready to tell me, he will. I think about making the offer to both of them for more self-defense classes. Javier does teach one at the local gym. I make sure, as we pass the gym, to mention it. Neither of them says a word. So, it's that kind of day. We eat out at the local diner, which is always a treat for me because of the fluffy meringue pies that they bake fresh daily. And while we're out, I see Javier Esperanza, who comes in, slides in at a table not far away, and orders lunch. He sees me and nods, and I nod back. "Hey, kids, I'm going to have a quick word with Mr. Esperanza." Lanny gives me a glare. Connor frowns and says, "Don't sign me up for anything." I promise not to and slide out of the booth. Javier sees me coming, and as the waitress sets down his coffee, he indicates the chair across from him. I slip into it. "Hey," he says, then takes a sip from his cup. "What's up? The kid okay?" "Connor's fine," I tell him. "Thank you again for jumping to the rescue so quickly."
"De nada. Glad he didn't need it."
"Mind if I ask you a question?" He glances up at me and shrugs.
"Shoot. Wait, hang on."
The waitress is back, delivering a bowl of soup and a piece of coconut meringue. "Okay." He waits for that last until she's out of earshot and clearly minding her own business, and although I don't need the caution, I appreciate it. "You know Mr. Cade? Sam Cade?"
"Sam? Yeah, sure. Not a bad shot for a Chair Force guy."
"Chair Force?"
"I like it better than Flyboy. I mean, they do most of their work sitting down."
Javier grins to show there's no real ill will.
"Cade's all right."
"Why?
He bothering you?"
"No, nothing like that. I just... it was odd having him show up with Connor. I wanted to be sure." Javier takes it seriously. He thinks about it for a moment, idly spooning his soup and letting it fall back to splash in the bowl, then finally takes a mouthful as if he's reached a decision.
"Everybody I know who knows him likes him," he says. "Doesn't mean he can't be bad, you know. But my instinct says he's okay."
"Why? You want me to look into it?"
"If you can."
"Okay. one good thing about being the range master. I know damn near everybody in this town.
Only Sam's new to town. Hadn't he said that?
He hasn't been here all that long, and he's planning on leaving at the end of a 6-month lease. Looking back on it, that seems troubling. Like someone staying a step ahead of trouble. Or, again, I'm just utterly, hopelessly paranoid. Why do I care? I can avoid him easily enough. I managed not to run into Cade before, and I can duck him going forward.
He offered to do some work on my house, I say to Javier, as some sort of excuse.
Yeah, he's good with that, he says. He put a new roof on my cabin right after he moved in. I think he used to work with his dad in construction, and the price was good. Better than I would have gotten in town. And none of the local guys can nail shingles on straight. And they can't shoot for shit, either.
I wasn't trolling for a testimonial, but I got one.
Well, some part of me says, quite reasonably, the roof still has to get fixed.
Thanks, I tell Javier. He waves his spoon at me to dismiss that.
Us outsiders gotta look out for each other, he tells me. And I think he believes it, that he and I are the same kind of outsiders. We're not, of course. But it's a little comforting to imagine.
I leave him to his pie and go back to mine, chocolate meringue, just in time, because Lanny and Connor have started shaving bits off the side of the slice and hoping I won't notice. They've already finished theirs.
Do not touch the pie, I tell them sternly, which gets me a shared look and eye roll. Lanny licks her fork.
That's a crime.
Back in the old days, I would use the words hanging offense. I wonder if they've ever noticed that I stopped.
I eat my pie, and we head back to Stillhouse Lake.
That afternoon I take a short walk up the hill to the neat little rustic box of Sam Cade's place and knock. It's 3 p.m., which around the lake seems a reasonable time to come calling, and sure enough, I catch him in the cabin. Sam seems surprised to see me, but he manages to keep it polite. He hasn't shaved, and the golden stubble on his chin glints in the light. He's got on a lightweight denim shirt, old jeans, and waffle stomper boots, and he waves me inside as he heads back toward the kitchen I can clearly see over a pass-through counter.
Sorry, he says. Close it, will you? I've got pancakes to turn.
Pancakes? I echo. Seriously? At this hour?
Never too late or too early for pancakes. If you don't believe that, you can turn around and go, because we are never going to be friends.
It's a funny, quirky thing to say, and I find myself laughing while I'm closing the door behind me. The laugh dies as I realize I've stepped inside a cabin with a man I hardly know, and the door is closed, and anything can happen now. Anything. I take a quick look around. It's small, and he doesn't have much. A couch, an armchair, a laptop. Parked on a small wooden desk that fits in the corner. The laptop's lid is up, and the display shows one of those Northern Lights wavy screensavers. Sam has no television that I can see, but a nice vinyl stereo setup with an impressive record collection that must be hell to move with. Bookcases on one wall, crammed full. Not the lifestyle I've developed, where nothing is cherished or necessary. I get a real sense of him having a life. Small. Self-contained. But real. And vital. The pancakes smell delicious. I follow him into a small galley kitchen and watch as he teases one loose from the pan and flips it in the air with the showmanship and dexterity of someone who's practiced that move a lot. It's impressive. He puts the pan back on the gas fire and gives me an unguarded smile.
So, he says. You like blueberry pancakes?
Sure, I say. Because I do, not because of the smile. I am immune to the smile. That offer you made about helping me out with the house, is that still on the table?
Absolutely. I like working with my hands, and that roof needs replacing. We can negotiate a good price.
If the blueberry pancakes are your negotiating move, it might not work. I ate pie today.
I'll take my chances.
He watches the pancake that's on the fire and removes it when it's perfectly toasted.
It gets added to a pile of three already done, and he hands me the plate.
No, you made those for you.
And I'll make some more. Go on, eat. They'll just get cold while I make the next set.
I use the butter and syrup set out on the table, and when he says it's fine, I pour myself a cup of coffee from the pot that's on the warmer. It's strong, and I add a swirl of sugar. I'm halfway through the pancakes, and damn, they are warm, fluffy, and tasty, with sweet, tart bursts of flavor from the fresh blueberries. Then he pulls up a chair across from me and gets his own coffee.
They're okay? He asks. I swallow the bite I've taken and say,
Where the hell did you learn to cook? These are amazing.
He shrugs. My mom taught me. I was the oldest, and she needed the help.
Something comes across his face when he says that, but he's looking down at the pancakes, and I can't tell if it's wistfulness or a sign that he misses her, or something else entirely. Then the moment's gone, and he digs in with real appetite. Works with his hands, loves to cook. Decent to look at. I start to wonder why he's on his own out here at the lake. But then, not everybody conforms to the love, marriage, baby life plan. I don't regret my kids. I only regret the marriage that produced them. Still, I can understand the lonely, solitary life better than most, and how harshly others can judge it. We eat in companionable silence for the most part, though he asks me about the budget for the roof and discusses the possibility of putting a nice deck on the back of the house, which is something I've been thinking of in my rich fantasy life. It's a big step. Not just repairing the house, but actually improving it. It sounds suspiciously like putting down real roots. We haggle easily over the roof repair pricing, and I balk at the deck. Commitment is not my strong suit, nor, I suspect, is it Sam Cade's, because when I ask how long he's going to be around, he says, Not sure. My lease is up in November. I might be heading on. Depends on how I feel. I like the place, though, so we'll see. I wonder if he's including me in the place. I scan him for signs of flirting, but I don't read any. He seems like a human dealing with a human, not a man sniffing around after a maybe-available woman. Good. I'm not looking for a relationship, and I can't stand pickup artists. I finish my pancakes before him and, without asking, take my sticky plate and fork and cup to the sink, where I hand-wash them squeaky clean and put them on the drain board. There's no automatic dishwasher. He doesn't say anything until I reach for the cooled pan and the batter bowl. No need, he says. I'll take care of that. But thanks. I take him at his word and turn to look at him as I dry my hands on a lemon-yellow dish towel. He seems perfectly at ease, focused on his pancakes, which are on the verge of disappearing. I say, What are you really doing here, Sam? He arrests the motion of his fork and leaves the pancake bite dripping syrup in the air for a few seconds, then deliberately finishes the journey to his mouth. He chews, swallows, takes a deep swig of coffee, and then puts his fork down to push back in his chair and meet my gaze. He looks honest and a little pissed. Writing a book. I think the question is, what are you? He asks me. Because damn if I don't think you've got a hell of a lot of secrets, Ms. Proctor. And maybe I shouldn't get involved, even if it's just climbing all over your roof for money. Your neighbors don't know much about you, you know. Old Mr. Claremont round the lake, he says you're skittish. A little standoffish. I can't say I disagree with him. Even if you did sit like a good guest and eat my pancakes and make decent conversation. His response, I think, is a marvel of deflection. I feel defensive when just an instant ago I was on offense, hoping to score some kind of telling reaction in the event that Sam Cade isn't who he claims to be. Instead, he's turned the mirror on me and put me on my back foot, and I admire that. Don't trust it, per se, but oddly enough, I give him points for it. I'm almost amused as I say, Oh, I'm standoffish, all right. And as to why I'm here,
I guess it's none of your business, Mr. Cade.
Then let's just keep our mysteries, Ms. Proctor.
He scrapes up some syrup and sucks it off the fork, then carries his dishes toward the sink.
Excuse me.
I step aside. He washes things with efficient motions, takes on the batter bowl and the pan and spatula. I let the running water fill the silence, cross my arms, and wait until he shuts the tap off, slots items in the drain board, and picks up the dish towel to dry off. Then I say,
"Fair enough. I'll see you tomorrow about the roof.
9 in the morning, all right?"
His expression, still calm and mobile and unreadable, doesn't shift much when he smiles.
"Sure," he says. 9 it is. Cash the end of every day until I'm done?
Sure.
I nod. He doesn't make an effort to shake my hand, so I don't offer, and I let myself out. I walk down the steps of his cabin and pause on the downhill winding path to take in a slow breath of thick lake air. It's muggy and heavy out here in the slow Tennessee heat. When I let my breath out, I still smell the pancakes. He really is an amazing cook.
The kids only have another week of school left, which brings with it the stress of last-minute tests. Connor stresses, that is. Lanny doesn't. I see them off on the bus at 8 a.m., and by 9 I've made some coffee and put out a box of store-bought pastries, since I can't hope to compete with Cade's pancakes. He knocks promptly on the hour, and I let him in for coffee and crullers, and we work out what he'll need to do the repairs. He takes cash up front to get supplies and heads back up to his cabin. I see him go past 15 minutes later in an old but powerfully built pickup whose primary color is Bondo gray with patches of faded green. I check the sicko patrol while he's gone. Nothing new presents itself. I count the number of posts, and it's down again. I keep a frequency chart in Excel, tracking the interest our names have online, and I'm pleased to find that as Melvin's atrocities are outdone by others, by lust killers, spree killers, fanatics with a cause, jihadists, some of our stalkers seem to be losing interest. I hate to use the phrase getting a life, but it's possible they are, that they're moving on. Maybe someday we can, too. It's a faint hope, but any hope at all is a new feeling for me. Cade returns just as I'm printing off the slender list of new stuff and filing it away. I have to leave a couple queued to the printer, which always worries me, but there's no choice. I close and lock my office door and go out to meet him. He's already setting up a ladder against the roof, making sure it's safely anchored in the grass. He's got a load of tar paper, shingles, and a tool belt that he's securing around his waist, dangling tack hammers and bags of nails. He's even got a battered trucker hat on to keep the sun off, and a bandana trailing out the back to cover his neck. Here, I hand him a closed aluminum water bottle with a carabiner clip. Ice water. You need any help?
Nope, he says, looking up at the rise. I should be able to get this side finished before dark. I'll take a break around 1.
I'll have lunch for you, I tell him. Then I'll leave you to it.
Sounds good.
He clips the water bottle to his belt and picks up the first load, which he's fitted with a rope carry that he fits over his shoulders like a bulky backpack. I hold the ladder as he swarms up it, moving as if he's carrying a load of feathers, and step back to make sure he's sure-footed up there. He is. The pitch of the roof hardly seems to faze him at all. Sam waves, and I wave back, and as I turn to go back inside, I see a police car cruising by, moving slow with tires crunching gravel. It's driven by Officer Graham, who nods to me when I lift a hand in greeting and speeds up to head up toward the Johansson's cutoff, toward where his place sits farther back. I remember that he sort of half-invited me to join him one evening for shooting practice, but I also think about the fact that he's going to have his kids with him, and I don't want to bring mine. So I make myself a mental promise to drop by with a tin of cookies or something that makes me seem more peaceful, but not interested. By lunchtime, I've completed 2 client jobs and posted for more work. One pays by the time I've made the spaghetti and meatballs and salad, and Sam Cade comes down to eat with me over the small dinner table. The other client pays by the end of the day, which is a welcome change. I have to chase a lot of payments. The sound of Cade up on the roof is weirdly comforting once I get used to it. I'm a little surprised when I hear the alarm sound, its sharp, repeated warning beeps, and the punching of the code to stop it. "We're home," yells Lanny from down the hall. "Don't shoot." "That was mean," Connor tells her, and then I hear an oof, as if she's thrown a sharp elbow at him. "It was." "Shut up, Squirtle. Don't you have nerd things to do?" I leave the office and head down to greet them. Connor pushes by me without saying a word, face dark, and slams the door of his room firmly. Lanny shrugs when I meet her halfway to her room.
"Sensitive," she says.
"What, it's my fault?"
"Squirtle."
"It's a Pokemon. They're kind of adorable."
"I know it's a Pokemon," I tell her. "Why are you calling him that?"
"Because he reminds me of one with his hard shell and soft underbelly."
It's a non-answer, and she shrugs, all loose shoulders and rolling eyes.
"He's just pissed because he blew his test."
"I got a B,"
Connor shouts through the door. Lanny raises one eyebrow in a sharp arc. I wonder if she's practiced that in front of a mirror.
"See? He got a B. Clearly he's losing his edge."
"Enough," I say sharply. And as if to punctuate it, there are 3 percussive raps on the wood overhead. Lanny yelps, and I realize that Cade is now working at the back of the house, and she and Connor wouldn't have seen him from the front as they came in. "It's all right," I tell them, as Connor throws open his door, eyes gone wide and blank with panic. "That's just Mr. Cade. He's on the roof replacing shingles." Lanny draws in a deep breath and shakes her head. She pushes past me to go into her room. Connor, on the other hand, blinks and shifts to something quite different. Interest.
"Cool. Can I go help him?"
I consider that. I consider the risk of my son tumbling off the edge of a roof, falling off a ladder. And then I weigh that against the hunger I see in him. The need to be around an adult male. One who can show him things I can't, who can represent something other than the pain, fear, and horror his father does now. Is it smart? Probably not. But it's right. I swallow all my worry and force a smile as I say, "Sure." I won't lie. I spend the next few hours outside, clearing up all the mess that Cade and Connor are cheerfully throwing down, and watching for any sign that my son might get overconfident, overbalance, and get himself hurt, or worse. But he's fine. Nimble, well-balanced, having the time of his life as Cade shows him the science of how to create a solid, overlapping roof pattern. It heals me a little inside to see the fierce, real smiles that Connor flashes and the genuine pleasure he's taking in doing the work. This, I think, this is a day he will remember. A good day. It's one of those memories that will pave the way to better things for him. I hate it, just a little, that I'm not the one to share in it directly. My son doesn't look at me with the same hero worship, and I think he never will. What we have is real love, but real love is messy and complicated. How can it not be, with our history? It's easy for him to be with Sam Cade, and for that I'm grateful. I shut up, clean up, and while the heat's a bit much for me, the work's good and healthy. We eat dinner together around the table, though Cade insists he's not fit for company as is. Lanny has taken over the kitchen and sternly commands him to go home, get cleaned up, and come back. And I can tell he's amused by having this fierce goth child ordering him around while wearing a flowered apron. He leaves and returns, freshly showered. His hair is still damp and clinging to his neck, but he's in a clean shirt and jeans. Deck shoes this time. Lani has made lasagna, and we dig in with real hunger, the 4 of us. It's delicious, layered with explosions of flavors, all fresh except for the pasta, which she's conceded to buy from the store.
Connor is incredibly voluble about all that he's learned today. Not at school, but how to hammer in a nail straight with one sharp blow, how to line up shingles, how to keep your balance on an incline. Lanny, of course, rolls her eyes,